Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1972. The album is Radio Dinner. The artist is National Lampoon. My guest is Mark Hirschhorn. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Jason. My pleasure.
So, okay, so you picked an album that, as we just were talking about briefly before I started recording, I had heard only bits and pieces of, probably some of the more offensive stuff. And I say offensive with every piece of knowledge that was the intent. But it is, yes. Man, holy crap. So this is their first album, to give people a little perspective. If you've never heard it, be prepared to be shocked, because I think that's part of the point of it. It's done in this very, like, it's clearly a bunch of, like, upstarts in their 20s who are just like, you know, or maybe late 20s, either way, they're just like, they really want to say fuck you to as many people as possible.
But upstarts that really launched an entire avenue of comedy. I mean, you know, when you think about it, I mean, the guys on this is, you know, like you said, it's National Lampoon's first album, and this was coming off of a couple of years of having their magazine, which to me, I was just moving from elementary school into junior high school, and I could get my hands on this magazine. And it was just so shocking to read this sort of thing. I don't know if you probably remember this cover. They were famous for this cover where they had a gun held to a dog's head and said, yeah, buy this magazine or we'll kill this dog.
Uh-huh.
And it was just like, wow. And it's on the newsstand.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Eventually they actually used that as the one half of the picture disc of That's Not Funny, That's Sick. So, yes. which is the one that I have framed in my office, mostly because I really love that photo because it's so upsetting. Again, they have this. It's like, hey, look at, we're clearly being playful with this just really upsetting subject matter at every turn.
But the, you know, the voices on this, I mean, Christopher Guest is all over this thing. You know, it's mostly his thing, it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And then Michael O'Donohue, who was one of the lead writers when Saturday Night Live would take off 4 years from this album's coming out.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of other really interesting performers on here that we can talk about if you want as we get into it or whatever. But
yeah.
It's this really interesting pastiche of sort of what the political satire climate was like in that slice of time where Nixon is getting reelected. All the stuff around his reelection hadn't quite come to light yet.
Yeah.
And yet he's clearly, at least in the eyes and minds of these satirists, a figure ripe for derision.
Yeah. And it's, man, he's, so many people, I feel like, credit him with, they credit him with the destruction. I mean, these are people who had just been able to vote or maybe were about to be able to vote. And this is the example they're given of what happens if you vote. Like, yes, it's just, yes, like, that's just, that would tear you up. So why would you not want to satirize that? I feel like,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
The cover, I'll just real quickly go over the cover. The cover is, it looks like a TV dinner, but it also is shaped intentionally like a radio, and it's very, it's just so friggin' weird. And it's got an NRA label on it. It has, yes, a big shield on it that says chipped beef, like it's official chipped beef, which is strange. It's fantastic.
And in a record store, this was so arresting because the colors are like this vibrant kind of purple tablecloth.
Yeah, right.
All this just really vivid, weird, like you said, imagery. Although, I mean, there's nothing innately strange about it, but it's just, even the shape of the, you know, the foil thing that the dinner comes in, it just looks bizarre.
Uh-huh. did you grab this album sight unseen, or had you not heard of it? Is what I mean. Did you see it in the store, or like what's your experience with it?
There, well, like I said, I was a fan of the magazine, and this album had come out, and I grew up in San Francisco, and there was a guy named Gene Nelson who, when I was, you know, in junior high or getting into junior high school, he had the late night show going into midnight. And between 10 and 11, he would play old radio shows. And between 11 and midnight, he would play comedy. And he, as soon as this album came out, he played the first cut, the Deteriorata cut, mm-hmm, off of it. And it's so, you know, if you had any exposure to the original Deserterata, mm-hmm, which was what they were making fun of, it was such a dead on parody of it that it was just like, I have got to get this. And then that opened up the entire rest of the album. And as we were, again, discussing before we started recording, there are cuts on here we literally cannot play for
right,
you.
Right, yeah. I mean, I will say, like, given the stuff that I have chosen to play on the podcast in terms of clips before, mostly for perspective and mostly with the understanding that depending, like, I try and give people a little context. If I'm playing something that was racist for the sake of it or something like that, where it's just like, hey, this is old timey in the 20s and they quote unquote didn't know any better, then I'm like, well, here, guys, different time. If I feel like most of the stuff on here I could play if we gave proper context, given that, you know, I mean, if you're going to be offended by bad words, you're going to be offended by bad words. But if I give you a little context in terms of history, and it's strong, it, like, in terms of satire, it's biting. And I feel like important in that way, you know?
Very much so. I mean, I think anybody who is not kind of familiar with this specific point in time, if you listen to this sort of, you know, sight unseen or ears unheard, you go, what is this? I don't even understand what they're talking about, because the things are really, like you said, it's very pointed and very sharp. But unless you knew the atmosphere of what was going on, I don't think a lot of people would kind of understand what they were trying to do with the pieces in this album.
Definitely. Is there anything that, pardon me, so sorry. Is there anything in this that resonated with you? And I'm probably obviously speaking of one particular thing, but that resonated with you based on where you grew up.
Oh, well, yes. Based on that is the piece we can't play. The Pull the Tragos is the name of the cut. And it's this fantastic Joan Baez send up. And they specifically mention Marin County, which is where I was raised.
Uh-huh.
All because San Quentin Prison is here in Marin.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's all in, I mean, we can talk about what the piece is about, because that's nothing, but it's the piece is in support of African-American prisoners uprising to have equal rights with the other prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, as Joan Baez is singing, we're going to remain safe in our homes. You guys, we support you. Mm-hmm. Go for it, but we're not getting involved. We're not getting involved.
It's like it's so great, because it's very easy to go. If I watch, there's a great, I don't know if you've seen the Smothers Brothers documentary, Smothered, but it's great. It's a wonderful documentary. It gave me some new perspective on, like, my favorite comedians, and in it, there's a bunch of stuff about Joan Baez, who obviously had you know, like, a very, like, well known. Legal battle because of her husband being arrested for going to jail for draft dodging, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
And so it's heartbreaking. And it's like, she's obviously a wonderful musician who had a great heart, but it's also very satisfying to hear, to hear these guys tear her apart a little bit. Cause you know, it's not, hey, she's a bad person. It's very much like, you know what, let's get some perspective. And they do it in the harshest way possible.
And I think they're really holding her up as an example of the music of the day, not so much this is just what Joan Baez is about.
Sure, sure.
It's all about this sort of liberal, you know, these songs that would come out about rights and things like that without really thinking about sort of unintended consequences.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And again, just how easy it is to be either an armchair critic or a guitar slinging soldier. It becomes one of those things. It's just on the border of hypocrisy, even if you're speaking up for the right thing. And it's a fine line to walk. And I think that's the thing National Lampoon does very well, but it also can be super off-putting, especially 40 years later.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I told my wife about the lyrics in this song and she just was aghast.
Of course.
Just
of
aghast. Course. Another thing that I loved about this was the use of Jackson Beck, who was, because I said I was, you know, I would listen to these old radio shows and I became a big fan of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Jackson Beck was an announcer who was all over these things. And most people would remember him if they'd ever seen any reruns of the original Superman TV show.
Oh, yes. Right. Okay.
Because he was the guy that would do the thing up front. You know, it's sort of the introduction of Superman.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they use him as an announcer on this game show called Catch It and You Keep It, which is, this isn't a pointed parody at all, but it's so fantastic about the inane nature of game shows. Even in 1972, it was like, these things are crazy. And it's not like they've gotten any better in the intervening, you know, 45 years.
Sure. Oh, my God. It's fantastic. That's yeah, Catch It and Keep It, which, by the way, I was just waiting for when does a piano get dropped on somebody, which really was what I was expecting. Just the whole bit, for, and again, I'll play clips from as much of this stuff as possible, but the whole bit is literally they're throwing things off of a building.
Yeah.
And whatever you get to catch, whatever you can catch, you get to keep, and then eventually just escalates to impossible to catch and deadly. It's just dumb. It's very silly, but it's the best way, I think, to parody something like that. Yeah. It does. I think it still resonates.
And get ready, because here it comes! And he caught it! Take a look inside the box, Ron.
There's a watch. And money.
Yes, it's a surprise bonus of two crisp $100 bills. Now, Ron, I'm holding a lovely piece of American Tourister luggage. Would you like to try for it?
Well, I don't know.
I'm going to open this suitcase, Ron, and place inside it a $500 Spiegel catalog gift certificate. Now, how do you feel?
Can I ask my wife?
Go for it, Ron. Go for it.
Well, okay. She's the boss.
It's a bit on the bulky side, so you'll have to be pretty agile.
I'll give it a try.
Ron had better be agile indeed, because what he doesn't know is that in addition to the $500 Spiegel catalog gift certificate, the suitcase also contains not one, not two, but three solid gold bars weighing 85 pounds each.
Another element that really kind of, to me, talked about how much they were trying to cleave to the feeling of the magazine. Well, first of all, they used, you know, these magazine, like Tony Hendren, people that were responsible for the magazine as writers and performers. But the Phono Funnies, which mm-hmm. are interspersed throughout the album, was, you know, a direct parallel to Photo Funnies, which they had in the magazine.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which would be like these really bad jokes sort of pasted onto photos of usually women with naked breasts.
Right.
So that was interesting.
Yeah.
And I thought the stuff with the Beatles was very interesting. With they've got this outrageous song with John Lennon, who's basically just down on everything, but mostly the Rolling Stones ripping off the Beatles.
Uh-huh. And it's all, I get the majority of, if not all of the lyrics are directly from his interview with, was it a Rolling Stone interview? I'm not sure.
It was a Rolling Stone interview, yeah. And then he basically put it to music.
Oh, man.
And his rant.
Just yeah.
This rant.
This is just at the point too where I I'll be honest, I don't know what the perspective on John Lennon was at the time, but the Beatles had only been broken up for 2 years, and it's refreshing for me because I mean, if you have any historical perspective, you know that maybe John Lennon wasn't the nicest guy in the world, and it's really funny to listen to this kind of remind you of that fact. You know.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the Beatles have taken on sort of a holy significance now. So yeah. Much time has passed, but at the time, it was just like, no, this is a great band, and they split up, and everyone wanted to point their fingers at John and Yoko for being responsible.
Right.
So it's like, all right, let's do that. There's also a Yoko Ono thing in here too. At the very, I think it's at the end of that piece,
mm-hmm.
where she just goes, "The dream is over."
Yes. I think there's the only Beatle they don't shit on in this album is Ringo. Ringo gets away scot-free. Lucky him.
That's as he should.
As he should. We could do. I mean, let's see. We've talked about Deteriorata, which is just a very just the original song, which I did finally have to listen to. It's very unusual, and this is spot on.
Yeah, it's this weird. It's this speaking piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's they used Norman Rose to do the thing. And Norman Rose used to do a thing called was it Norman Rose or another guy? His voice sounded very familiar. Where it was this sort of beat poetry comedy thing.
Uh huh.
And it was very much sort of that sort of idea. But here they took everything from Desiderata and just twisted it. And some of it literally makes no sense.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And what's really funny is listening to it, it feels like a parody of something that came 40 years later, which was that stupid sunscreen song that apparently everybody when I was in high school, that had to be that your song for your high school class. But it feels like it's filled with advice, and most of it is just absurd nonsense, but it sounds great.
And I think those things probably come along once every generation. There's mm-hmm. a song like that. If we went back further, you know, there's probably one somewhere in the mid 50s that was very similar.
Oh yeah, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. And it should be noted, of course, and maybe also not surprising, but Christopher Guest is involved musically too, just playing guitar, arranging mm-hmm. most of the music on this. I don't know where his, and this shows my ignorance, I don't know where his involvement with National Lampoon began, unless it was just National Lampoon Radio, or did he write for the magazine too?
I think he was part of the magazine as well. I mean, he's so involved in this album, I have to assume that he was part of that group with Michael O'Donohue and Tony Hendra. I mean, Tony Hendra was in Spinal Tap.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, obviously their connection plays through there, which is interesting.
Yeah.
I saw a name actually connected to the Profiles in Chrome cut, which was, again, very bizarre. The idea that Richard Nixon is, you know, in... hit the re-election facing a Pontiac GTO. But Alex Bennett is a name of a guy. He was a disc jockey for years here in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, he must've been in radio in New York at some point if he was part of this, but anyway, that's the only time his name is attached to this thing. But I was trying to pick it out because I know him, I've known him over the years, but I couldn't tell exactly which voice actor he was.
Uh-huh. Do you have a favorite piece off of this in general, or is it for you just a complete album?
Well, it's interesting. In listening to the whole thing, there are some things that I just go, man, I didn't really care for that particular cut when it came out.
Yeah.
Still don't really kind of either don't get it or it just kind of doesn't really resonate with me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, the Deteriorata is just a great sort of table setting for the piece, although it's a little bit long.
Mm-hmm.
Catch It and You Keep It, I think, is again, it's just, that's something that actually holds up, I think.
Definitely.
Because of game shows. The Magical Misery Tour is just an amazing curiosity. But if you want to kind of play a short thing to get into it, and they don't have these commercials anymore, but those Fabulous 60s.
Yeah.
Which is the record commercial for it from television. Right.
Yeah.
And it's got Christopher Guest as Bob Dylan hawking this series of protest songs. And it's funny, even to the point of fact that they just play literally a split second of a piece.
That's really wonderful. Oh, you know, there's a bit in here, too. Shit. And I apologize. I can't remember what track it was. But there's a bit where, and it might be one of the very small ones, where they're doing something about Amelia Earhart. And then they start referencing what Firesign Theater would have done with the sketch.
Oh yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's so great. Again, it went way the hell over my head. Other than knowing that, yeah, they're clearly referencing that. A lot of people thought that Firesign Theater was too intellectual. Too heady even for a lot of people at the time, which is why that sometimes they're hard to get into.
And there's some great albums that you've probably featured on the show that were contemporaries of this, like The Credibility Gap.
Yep. Yep.
You know, different guys, but all in the same school.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, eventually kind of they merge forces with at least with the Christopher Guest end of things.
Yeah. I think I've written a number of things over the years, but one of the things I was most excited about that actually ended up not happening was they were going to do a new National Lampoon stage show.
Oh,
in New York. And this was like in the, I gotta say, early 90s.
Uh-huh.
And they had all the meetings in Los Angeles, which were where I was living at the time. And my name got thrown in the mix somewhere, and I started going to these meetings, and we started writing sketches. Oh. And I was so excited. And then the backers basically evaporated.
Oh.
And the whole thing fell apart. But it was just, oh, it was great. We were meeting at Dick Clark's office.
Wow.
In Burbank. And yeah, it was great. It was going, oh, this is like a kind of a culmination of this amazing thing that started in 1972, and now it's 1992, and now nothing's happening.
That's too bad. I've had one guest who's been on the show before. We discussed Gold Turkey. And we took two whole episodes to do it because he had so much to say about it. But yeah, he I think he said he had a couple pieces even published in the magazine. I was just so jealous because, you know, I wasn't around for any. This is one thing, like National Lampoon to people nowadays, it's going to be just something before the title of a movie, but not even anymore because Vacation wasn't National Lampoon's Vacation. The remake was just Vacation. Yeah. So even that doesn't, maybe Van Wilder is the one thing people might associate with National Lampoon anymore.
Yeah, such a great point in time. And I mean, it also, you know, was the direct predecessor to Animal House. You know, all these guys were writing for, they wrote Animal House. They, half of them appeared in Animal House in kind of non-speaking roles in the fraternity. And it was that same sense of humor. And I think, I do think political correctness has currently made it so you kind of can't get away with this except for microcasting to somebody through your YouTube channel or something.
Right. No, but, that could be true. I feel like, I need to listen to this album a few more times, honestly, to give it some more perspective. But there are a couple things in it, while that, at least to me, because while I might stick to a lot of PC rules, I also completely aware when something's being ironic that it gets a break. You know, it gets a pass from me. I try very hard to do that, and most of the stuff on this passes for me anyway. It's very pointed. When it's actually more pointed than some of their later albums. I think some of their later albums do have shock for the sake of shock, just a few times. Not as, again, they're not, you know, they're not garbage comedy that you might find where it's just like, let's just say some words to be dirty. You know, they're just maybe a little less thoughtful than some of the other stuff, but I think maybe some people confuse it because it's very they're very joyful with how they do these awful things. There's something about them. Like, Christopher Guest sounds like this, and this is no insult because he's a hero of mine, but he sounds like this spoiled little brat who's getting to do something naughty. Like, he's like, I just said something naughty and awful. Like, he always sort of sounds like that to me, and that could be my own bias, but I don't know. There's something about him that's where the joy, I think, comes from.
But I think I agree with you, and I also think that's part of what drives him to do each of his projects. Because every time he does something, it's generally something that's never been touched on before.
Sure.
And so there's this sense of delight in what he's doing, and I think probably, you know, when he does it on film, he's able to kind of tamp it down a bit. But in terms of seeing that sort of smile under it all, that cruel smile. But here, I think you're right. You can hear it in some of the pieces.
Like really far out, you know, what George did, you know? Like, he picks up on these really far out things, you know? You know, like the fact that, like, we're ripping off all this copper, you know, from Bolivia, you know, for our stereos. And, like, you know, like the blacks, you know? Like, how we're, like, really just ripping them off, too.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, he picks up in these things that are just so far away, man. And, like, Bangladesh, you know, like, he did this whole trip with these starving kids, you know. And it was, man, it was, like, far out because, like we're not only, like, ripping off those people, but, like, you know, these people in Japan, you know. Like, that's where the plastic comes from for the albums.
Yeah,
man,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
He's far out, man. He's,
I mean, he spreads himself so thickly over our earth, you know.
So beautiful,
And I also like, you know, I can tell it's him, obviously, but what's funny is I wasn't looking at the album, so I was kind of expecting some of the usual gang, but there were no Bill Murray's and none of that yet on this.
This all very much preceded all that SNL. And if you look at things like even the Lemmings album, which was going to come along in the next year, there's John Belushi in there, a number of other guys. So it's like that class hadn't come together yet.
Yeah. There is Melissa Manchester's on this album throughout it. Like, she, which is great. There's a lot of people with, pardon me, just a lot of cred attached to this. The back, by the way, very sparse, but it tells you who plays everybody. And also has another piece of either weird old clip art or something custom made for this, which is a lady eating a Ritz cracker, and it's very weird and upsetting looking. It's like, it's very pretty, but it's also because she's got this crazy white blue hair. It's just, this whole thing is just very...
Yeah, well, it connects to the, I mean, they've got this, from the dinner on the front, there's these Ritz crackers and some sort of goo. I don't even know what that is.
I know.
But clearly that's the connection to that back picture, but it's just strange.
Do you remember hearing this thing for the first time? Like, what it did to your brain?
Yeah, because I immediately had to listen to it again. First of all, it's, you know, nothing like this that I can recall had really come out. And secondly, some of the pieces are so densely packed with voices and pieces going on and references that you just don't pick it all up.
Yeah.
So I remember that, and I this really did kind of touch off the fuse in my comedy mind. It was like, up until then, I mean, I was a huge comedy fan ever since I was a little kid, because my parents had, you know, the usual collection of party albums, party comedy albums like Bob Newhart.
Sure.
And Bill Cosby, God rest his career. things like The First Family.
Yeah.
And David Fry and all these, you know, typical albums that people from the 60s had in their stereo cabinet. So I was, my teeth were completely cut on that stuff. Alan Sherman.
Yeah, sure.
George Carlin, all that stuff. And then this thing came along, and this was not in their collection. This was one of the first things I think I bought, because I'd heard it, you know, I'd heard that first Deteriorata piece. And it was like, this is sending me in a different direction comedically.
Yeah.
And it was going out of that I started writing. You know, I started taking interest in improvisational comedy, just because to me, that's what a lot of this felt like. They, you know, it was almost like they'd workshop these things and then decided to write it up.
Yeah.
Or just do it in the studio and cut the middle out of it and just use that or whatever was going on.
Sure.
And the idea that there weren't comedians on here. I mean, there were comic writers that I didn't know who they were, other than the fact their names were on bylines in the magazine. But they weren't comedians in the sense of this is a stand-up comic or this is someone I've seen on the Carol Burnett Show.
Right,
or something like that. These were all unknown names to me, and yet they were really funny.
I feel like that's the kind of thing that you need to tell you that, oh, sometimes unknowns they're even unknown with their first project. Like, it's one of the, you have to be reminded of that. They're not ever present always.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing was, this was an album sort of to be discovered, and it didn't get widely released because of the controversial nature of so many of these cuts. So you could tell your friends about it, and they go, I'd never heard of that. And you'd play it for them, and their minds would be blown that this thing was available. And your parents let you buy this? And I said, yeah, they don't know what's on here.
I have to imagine this was a headphones album for you. Were you just sitting in your room with headphones on listening to this thing?
No, there were no, I didn't have headphones at the time. I had my own turntable.
Did you play it quietly?
Quietly enough. Yeah. And they even when they listened to it, some of it they kind of just shake their head and leave the room. They couldn't figure it out. And the thing about it today is this album is so hard to get. I mean, it was never released on cassette. It was never released on CD.
Yeah.
It's not available generally electronically. I mean, if you hadn't made it digitized your copy of the record for me.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have had a chance to kind of refresh myself on these bits.
That's
and
crazy.
Yeah, it's just great. It's almost like still having that rarity to listen to and share with your friends.
Yeah. That was actually one of my questions was, I mean, it sounds like you probably did play this for some people and blow a few minds yourself.
I did. I used to love trying to find something that was relevant yet unknown and try and play it for people. I remember I was a big fan of Stan Freberg's, man. I thought that guy was just a genius.
Yeah.
And when his United States album came out, I was in high school. I mean, I'd listened to it for years. And I had a high school American history class. And I told the teacher, hey, I want to bring this record in and play it. He goes, okay. And it took up two class worths because of the album size. And I got an A for the project for this. It wasn't even a project. I just got an A for the semester because I brought this thing in. And it was so weird that, I mean, he'd kind of heard about it, but there wasn't another student in my class that had any idea what this thing was.
Right.
And that, to me, the idea that you can teach through comedy has always been a big thing for me. I mean, I teach improv to business people and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do think it's a wavelength upon which a lot of educational elements can be laid.
I agree. Actually, I have to find the paper, but this Israeli doctor years ago did some pretty solid research on just how stuff sticks in your brain best with that layer of comedy added to it. And it's scientifically proven that you can do that, which I think is one of the funny, that's just one of the funny things about comedy in general. And that's one of the things why it sticks, something that makes you laugh sticks as well as something that's got rhythm in terms of music, you know, like that. I can wake up with a rhythm or a song in my head. Sometimes it'll just happen for the sake of comfort or whatever. But comedy has its own thing. Just because you once laughed at it, it's this instant memory, I feel like, that sticks with you.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I produced comedy for a long time in the San Francisco Bay Area, putting shows together, and I ran a comedy club in Seattle in the early 90s or early 80s. And then I've been teaching and performing improv for 30 years. And just comics even learn on a whole different wavelength than regular people. I've never met a group of people that have such fantastic memories as long as it's based around comedy and their performances somewhere. I mean, I've had comics come up to me 30 years after something happened and said, "Hey, remember we were hanging out in Seattle and we went to that store?" I go, "What are you talking about? How could that still be in your head? I don't understand." But there's something about comedy, and like you said, there's a connection to it that kind of, it's like putting a bookmark in your head or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's why I think it's fun on this show to either pick something that's brand new or something that you did grow up listening to, because you rarely do you forget the entire thing. Sometimes people are like, "Oh, I don't have it memorized like I used to," but some people do. Like, there are the diehard Fire Sign fans, they have the entire albums memorized, and it's fucking crazy. I love it. Like, I say crazy in a very positive way. I think it's amazing that they can still do that. Because I, like, the stuff that I grew up with, other than the music, like Weird Al, I don't really have, and maybe some Monty Python, I don't have a lot of that stuff stored. I don't know how I replaced it or what I replaced. Maybe it's other people's memories now, because I've interviewed so many people about comedy albums.
That's funny.
You know?
Yeah, Monty Python is a great example, because, again, that was right in my sweet spot. Kind of, I was just getting into high school, and I had a buddy of mine, and we found the show at the same time, not together, but we started talking about it, and we memorized like 35 sketches, and we would do them incessantly, much to the chagrin of many people around us. But yeah, that stuff all stuck.
Yeah.
The Fire Sign Theater stuff, I couldn't recite it word and verse, but I definitely remembered large chunks of it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, I mean, I know people that were huge fans of Kids in the Hall. I like Kids in the Hall, but I know people that were fanatical.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing for them. They know every sketch and every reference.
Yeah. Maybe that stopped for me when I felt like, oh, I got to start making my own stuff now. Like, I feel that could have, because I wasn't absorbing it in the same fanatic way, even if I still loved that old stuff just as much. Eventually, I just had to be like, I got to make a little room for my own
crap. It's like laying down a bed to plant a garden in, right? I mean, you've got all that stuff kind of layered in. You go, okay, now I'm going to plant my own stuff here. But I need this good, rich nutrient underneath what
it's
I'm
so
doing.
So true, yeah.
To prove it out, you know?
Have you ever been involved in or produced or acted on any comedy albums?
That's a good question. I don't think I have. I mean, the closest I got to comedy albums was just my podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This was years ago. I was just senior year of high school. There was a guy who was this dude that I'd been introduced to that was sure quadraphonic sound was going to be the thing of the future. It's kind of like people that think 3D television is going to be the big thing today.
Right, right.
So he wanted to put together these radio plays and hired me and a friend of mine to write these plays that specifically would make use of quadraphonic sound.
Wow.
So we had these kind of surround sound ideas of people like trapped in the jungle and things like that. So I acted in those, but that wasn't really a comedy album.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think I had the good fortune of doing that.
Yeah. It's a rare thing when anybody says yes. I'm just always curious because I feel like sometimes that was something for me that once the digital age came around, I had, for some reason, desperately had to make my own, and I don't know why. It wasn't great, but I did do it, and it's very satisfying. You should do it.
Yeah, I never did stand up. I produced stand up and I perform improv, but I never said I don't have the time to sit here and hone an act. Which,
right.
After producing it for years and running a comedy club, I knew it is something that needs to be honed. And I go, I don't have the time, but I can make stuff up, so
sure.
I'll improv.
How Democracy Works, number 43, The Miracle of Free Elections.
Free elections depend upon a free people. From the earliest stages, the voice of the people must be heard at all times.
Sorry, boy, this caucus is for us Caucasians.
You know how Muskie got all those holes in his forehead? Learn to eat with a fork.
How about you and me going for a little spin?
Nomination for the presidency of these United States, a 1973 avocado green Pontiac GTO.
Representative of all the people responds to the will of the other people.
Those cynical manipulators of all that's best in America. Henry, what won't they stoop to?
So you said this album kind of changed your perspective. And so did you start getting a little more counterculture in your tastes too? Or was it specifically just National Lampoon? You just sought out more of their stuff.
Well, interestingly enough, one of the things it did, it made me want to get into the guts of comedy. Up until this album, I was a listener. I really enjoyed listening to comedy, but I didn't really ever think about how these things came together. They were just things I enjoyed listening to. Mm-hmm. I liked listening to funny people. And sort of coming out of high school, I got involved in the comedy scene in San Francisco. I started, you know, they had this annual San Francisco comedy competition here with, mm-hmm. you know, all sorts, you know, Robin Williams came in second in the first one, right? To a guy who became an English teacher. And I think he's still an English teacher, actually. And so I would get to see these guys live, but I would also be backstage with them. And I could, you know, I could see people sitting around and putting buttons on each other's jokes or giving them a suggestion of something that they thought of because it reminded them of something else. Mm-hmm. And I actually became less and less of a guy who wanted to watch comics work. I can't go into a club now and just sit and watch comedy. I have to go in the green room or hang out at the bar with the comics. If I sit there, I just go out of my mind because I'm going, what's everybody talking about right now?
Yeah.
You know, where I'm not.
Right.
And so it made it very difficult to become a true fan of comedy. I appreciate it. And I've worked with a lot of comics on their material, which is fun. I've written with Bill Maher and Jay Leno and Dana Carvey. And that was a fascinating process because all those people work completely differently.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting being part of those different processes. As far as counterculture, it didn't make me counterculture as much as it made me counter what everyone else is doing.
Yeah.
The idea that whatever I'm writing or whatever I'm involved in, we have to take a slightly different tack. We got to twist this somehow. Or it's just, particularly today, it just won't break through.
Right.
You know, you need that original voice to really make something capture someone's attention.
Is there anything that you know of now that's got... Well, I don't know that anything could have the bite of an album like this anymore, but is there anything that you can think of, the closest sort of maybe natural extension of what National Lampoon was in the 70s?
Well, it certainly isn't Saturday Night Live.
Not anymore, no, yeah.
I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
You know? I can't think of anything that captures anything in a real general fashion like they did. I mean, they really looked at the political scene, I guess. But if you think of things like Children's Hospital.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it's a very pointed, very funny, very sick, and not everything works in it.
Uh-huh.
But it was very focused on a particular thing, and it does that very well. And it's sort of sad that's come to an end, but it's had a good run.
Yeah.
There's, I mean, like John Oliver. I think John Oliver has taken the late night commentator to a completely different level. And I'm beginning to see that happen with Samantha Bee's show as well, you know, Full Frontal.
Yeah.
You know, where Oliver's kind of moved away from most of the trappings. He's still a guy in a tie sitting behind a desk, and Samantha Bee is just standing there.
Yeah. They're,
she's got nothing to hide behind. And that's very psychological, I think, the idea that she's just there laying it out.
It's true. And she has been, if I would pick a correspondent on The Daily Show that's ever been, I don't know, who's ever been like, I would just call her probably the strongest satirist on that show ever. And I love Stephen Colbert and I love all the others, but I feel like she's the one who's had the strongest point of view in terms of the stuff she's put together. Even if it's written for her, she's one of the strongest performers in terms of satire off that show.
I'd agree with her, and I agree with you, and I'd agree. I think her husband, Jason, is
God, so good.
is so funny. I mean, he's just, and it really takes what they both have is there's nothing they won't do.
Yeah.
I mean, the pieces you can think of that Jason's had his shirt off in, or he's in his underwear. Uh-huh. Or, it's just like, it's very much like, you know, when Will Ferrell started doing stuff where he'd come out and just like his guts hanging out.
Yeah.
And just putting it out there. Those things to me are very funny when artists are willing to say, you know, I need to use my whole essence to pull this character off.
Yeah. Yeah. And to do it in the name of not just satire, but sometimes like culture changing satire. I mean, it's great that, you know, being a goofball, for lack of a better term, can somehow have that impact. And I, you know, and it's the same with this album. It's a lot of this shit is really goofy, but it had a huge impact on a generation of comics and writers and just people in general.
Oh, I definitely think it did. And I think it was a milestone for the people on the album to give them permission to springboard into the different things they went off to do from here.
Mm-hmm.
Which is great. I mean, it's interesting that back then you had to somehow pull an album together, and this thing went through a couple of different producers before Blue Thumb Records agreed to release it.
Yeah.
Nowadays you can record whatever you want. You can put it up on YouTube and you're distributed.
Definitely. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it's a lot easier to get that permission given to yourself because, hey, I put it out there and I'm still alive. Nobody's mm-hmm. come after me.
Right.
And I mean, look at the popularity of some of these people on YouTube and Vine and things like that. You know, mm-hmm. they have catapulted into these major media projects just because of they've had 5 million views on something.
Yeah.
And so it's all very validating. Every kind of form of media, it seems, has its own validation. And in the world of records, the idea that I went to the trouble and got this thing pressed and now it's out. I'll claim responsibility for this, partially responsible for the widespread, I guess I'll say popularity, of a Christmas song called Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer.
Really?
May be familiar with.
Uh-huh.
And that was a question of, here's this guy, Elmo, what's his name, Dr. Elmo,
uh-huh.
He's a dentist, and he's got a bluegrass band on the side.
Uh-huh.
And he's playing in Tahoe, and there's another group that was on before they were the week before, but they couldn't get out of town because of the weather. So they stayed over a day or two, and one of the guys was friends with Dr. Elmo, says, hey, I got this Christmas song, and I think it'd be great for a bluegrass group, but I don't play bluegrass. So you can have it. And it was Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer.
Uh-huh.
So Elmo goes, yeah, I'll take that. And so he records it, and he presses like 500 singles, and he can't think what to do with them. And he happens to listen to the guy that I happen to be the producer of the morning show at KSFO, this guy Gene Nelson I mentioned earlier. This uh-huh. was another circular thing. When I was in junior high school, he was the overnight guy. When I decided to get a job in radio coming out of high school, he was the morning drive guy, and I eventually became his producer.
That's funny.
So he sends Gene this record, the drummer in his group sends Gene the record. And Gene plays it, and some people just hate it. They're
sure. going,
this is just a piece of shit. What the hell? He says, well, I'll tell you what. We'll open the phone lines for the next hour, and if we have more people who liked it that didn't like it, we'll play it again. And so I'm manning the phones. All these calls are coming in, and more people liked it, so we played it again. And before you know it, all of a sudden we're constantly getting requests for the thing. Well, the record isn't out. Elmo made 500 copies, 490 of which are in his garage. The other 10 he's given to his band to play for their friends, and the drummer sent it to us. So all of a sudden I'm getting phone calls, and Nelson goes on vacation 3 weeks before Christmas, and I start getting calls from radio stations sort of in concentric circles out from the Bay Area. We've heard about this song and we can't find it. So I would play it down these high quality phone lines for them to record and replay from their station.
Oh, wow.
So years later, last year, I'm interviewing Elmo for this magazine article about the success of his song. And he didn't know I was part of this mix at all. So I'm telling him this story. And he says, you're the guy. He says, you're the guy. He says, if it wasn't you, those boxes of records would still be in my garage. He said, because that was going nowhere.
Wow. That's fantastic. Just like to have the instinct to play this ridiculous thing on the air, you know, and then he's insisting, well, you know what? We'll try it again, which I think is a kind of a ridiculous instinct, but apparently was the right one. And then, wow, that's crazy. That is, you know, like you saying that, like I understand that it's a novelty hit, but there's obviously a part of me that, like, when I was 8 or 9, when did that come out? What year was that?
That would have been 79.
Holy crap. Wow. Way before that I would have expected. So when I was 8 or 9 and first heard it, like when they were playing on the radio one year, because I was overseas for a while, so that probably is why I didn't hear it growing up. And so 8 or 9, I heard it, and that just was the funniest. I thought it was the funniest thing on the planet because I was 8 or 9. And that's really funny. That's hilarious to have that kind of involvement with this big piece of culture. At least, you know,
it's so really funny. Yeah, it's really interesting. And then just that the way this stuff keeps coming around again, this idea that I get assigned to do this story with this guy who did this record, and it's like, all right, well, okay.
God, that's perfect. You know what I like to do is I feel like you've made the argument for the last 45 minutes, but like if you're going to condense it and ask people or tell people, if somebody says, why should I listen to National Lampoon? I only know Van Wilder. That's not my thing. What's a good reason to listen to this album as your first exposure to National Lampoon?
I think to listen to what cutting political satire really can be, or at least could have been 40 years ago. I think it can still be done today. Could it still be done the way they're doing it on this record? Probably in some sort of a related form. But the idea that it's done in such a way to mix music and commentary, and like you said, just some crazy stuff that doesn't really seem to even make sense, other than the fact it gives you a flavor of what was happening in the day.
Yeah.
Also, to kind of, I mean, if you're a Christopher Guest fan, listen to where he came from. These are his roots. You know, I mean, this stuff, he's famous for doing mockumentaries. Well, most of the stuff on this album is essentially a mocking of what was a real thing, whether it's Deteriorata or Catch It and You Keep It or any of these things. There's a mockumentary feel if you dig down deep enough to these things that you can go, oh, yeah, I could see where he'd be kind of ignited by these sort of bits.
George Jackson was the name. His blood was like a flame that lit the prison walls from dawn to dusk. Fire with fire, eye for eye, truth for truth in the blazing sky. He dropped the men of darkness as they came. Pull the triggers, niggers, we're with you all the way. Just across the bay. Because I can't be there doesn't mean that I don't care. So next time, brother, off a pig for me.
Yeah, he's a big hero of mine, you know, for the mockumentary specifically. But I feel like if I got to sit him down and talk to him for an hour, I would have to ask him about each one of these albums, because part of me also wants to see, like, I want to see the look on his face, because I want to see if there's any, like, embarrassment. He's like, oh, that was too much. Like, I want to know where his brain is at, because for a lot of people, like yourself, it's like, no, this is good. It is what it is. You have no reason to have any shame for it, because you didn't put it together, even if something's, like, not the best sketch. But he would have this very personal involvement in it that I really want to know what his opinion of it is now after that long career.
That would be great to find out, actually.
You know,
He's one of
those that I regularly, every couple months, I'm like, hey, is Mr. Guest available? So, you know, by the way, if you're out there, Christopher Guest, because you're not listening to this, but if you're out there, come on the show.
Come on, we love you, man. Yeah. We love you.
He's the best. Well, what I do not know, and I apologize, I don't know when this is going to come out, but no, do you have anything to promote?
Well, there's Succotash, the comedy podcast, which I often don't know when it's going to come out either. Uh-huh. I've tried so hard to make it weekly, and usually because of the real world impinging on my fantasy world,
sure.
I don't get to it for 2 weeks or sometimes even three. But I play clips of comedy podcasts, which is how I found out about your show originally. We featured your show on that. Mm-hmm. Also, I review podcasts every week on Splitsider.com and Huffington Post.
Awesome.
Because I just believe, although it's there's now more than 100,000 comedy podcasts, but we still need to promote them for some reason.
Yeah.
but there's new ones all the time. It's almost become aggravating
yeah.
as a reviewer because I keep trying to catch up and they're proliferating like rabbits.
Yeah. Yeah, they really are.
And they're getting more professional too, which is, as a podcaster myself, I'm always going, I got to kind of up my game a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because now we've got like professional broadcasting people are getting into this thing. You know, there's the Play It Network,
uh-huh.
which is all radio people.
Yeah.
That can't get jobs anymore. So now they're all doing podcasts.
That's funny. And you know, what's interesting is, again, this will come out by the time this is in any way solidified, but I've been kind of going the reverse because this radio distributor is like kind of interested in our podcast. And I have kind of tried to remind them, you know, there's some naughty language sometimes, but it's very interesting that you could go from podcast to radio at all anymore. That is shocking to me.
Yeah, but it's, I think the radio people are getting so desperate that they're now able to say, well, if podcasting's happening, let's do what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And I think what we'll start to see is the model of a radio station is going to sound very different than it does now,
yeah.
where that, you know, they've been for years doing this clock thing where they top load a bunch of ads at the end of the hour.
Right.
And then, so they kind of hook you in because it's like pure content for the first 8 minutes. You're going, oh, cool. And then bit by bit, you're sort of bombarded by commercials. And I think that medium is likely to change. A, they're losing sponsors.
Yeah.
But B, podcasting is this more self-contained medium. So I think they'll find a new way to kind of mix put the mix together.
I would like to see there, obviously I would like this, but I'd like to see that also develop into getting to hear more produced comedy on radio, because that's something I never got to grow up with. And I get so jealous hearing of people who got to grow up with Dr. Demento or with entire comedy channels, or even like you said, a comedy block would be nice. You know, every once in a while I've got the radio on. I actually listen to the radio occasionally. And when I do, it would be really great if I could hear something I'd never heard before.
Well, I think the main problem with that is it's moved away from personality radio. When I got hooked on radio, and it was the first thing I wanted to do when I got out of high school, which I did. I worked on radio for like 6 years. And it was personality driven radio that I used to listen to. That's why a guy could do an hour of old radio and an hour of comedy.
Yeah.
But now it's all, you know, it's all corporate. It's all, here's the playlist. Here's the number of commercials. Here's how many times you're going to play this song. And all that personality has been completely sanitized out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I think that's why there's such a proliferation of podcasts, because now podcasters can do exactly what they want and the audience can listen to exactly what they want.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And with the right podcasting app, you can flip past their advertisements.
Yeah. Yeah. Their
sorry.
Advertisements.
I don't like to admit
intro.
That I do that.
Well, it's just the way it is.
Yeah.
I tend to listen to them just because I'm going, okay, well, there's an advertiser I could go after.
But yeah, right, right.
I'm still unsponsored. I just, you know, other than my wallet.
Right, right.
But for me, it's more a labor of love. It's just like I loved radio broadcasting and I did it for a while and I just said, okay, well, I've done this. Now what happens? And I got into the world of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But I still, that's still that desire to perform in some way, that desire to bring something to people that they're not hearing, that they're not aware of, whether it's content I'm creating myself or saying, hey, here's clips from some podcasts you're probably not aware of. That to me is kind of the magic of this particular medium. And probably the same as being a stand-up. I'm doing something for these people that no one else has done for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you, just out of curiosity, because you're in the right area, I mean, do you still listen to radio much?
I have the radio in my car on, but only to play podcasts through it.
Yep. No, me too. That's usually
yeah.
how it goes.
And I used to flip over just to hear the traffic reports, but now with things like Waze, I don't even have to do that.
Oh yeah. Good point. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't listen to the radio. In fact, I was, I work at a branding company mm-hmm. In San Francisco, and we're right across the street from this big radio TV station complex. That's all, you know, now the corporations have taken everything over. There's like, you know, four stations in there, but they just laid off the news staff from this very famous old radio station in San Francisco called KGO.
Yep.
And they shot like 35 people through the grease mm-hmm. all in one day. They just said, you're out.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, really?
Yeah, I know. That's it's so crazy. I'm friends with one of those people. Goes by the name John Rivers, and yeah. So I was actually just curious. Yeah, it's crazy that just the kind of my hope would be obviously like, hey, it'd be great if they could all band together and start their own podcast network, because it's like it's a specialty, like it's a very specialized skill. And it sucks to see that go by the wayside when it's, you know, there's some talent there and they serve a purpose.
Well, plus I think the biggest casualty on the programming side is news. It seems to be like the first thing to jettison.
Yeah.
It's like, well, nobody cares about this stuff. They can get it anywhere. But if you eliminate it from everywhere, then you can't find it anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I have a number of friends in the news business. And they're just like, they don't know what they're going to do or where they're going to go. Mm-hmm. And you just see so much news now that's just, can I trust this? I don't. What's the source? Where's this coming from?
Yeah.
And it's becoming, it's starting to get a little bit dangerous, quite frankly, because it's hard to track down facts in a lot of cases.
Yeah. It's a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox kind of
thing.
And
that's a good way to look at it. Exactly.
Well, that said, hey, you know what? Leaving it on a dark note with this album is okay. I think it's fine.
I think you're right.
You know? Well, thank you so much for doing this. Everybody, please listen to the Succotash. It is a great podcast. It's a lot of fun. And you've exposed me to a lot of new shows, which is the purpose. So that's great. I love that. And everybody, also go to lookingforwardmovie.com, which is where my political mockumentary is playing for the rest of the year. 11 months of vlogs. I think by the end of it, it's going to be about 14 hours of stuff. So start watching now. As always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.
Oh, hi, I'm Jason Klom.
Gaziza, I'm Alan Rickard.
Your last name is Rickard?
And we are the hosts of
Dispatches from Port Awesome, a news radio podcast.
This is Jason again. I host the well-reputed...
Reputed? This is Alan.
Reputed Comedy on Vinyl podcast, as well as some others. Alan, though.
I've been on some podcasts, also I'm an actor, and have been for nigh on several years.
The important part, though, is that while we're close friends, we found a bond when we discovered that we both love the greatest sitcom of the 90s.
Possibly of all time.
I won't refute that. The podcast will go through the entire series, from episode 1 to episode 97.
We'll be talking with other fans of the show, people who worked on the show, and you.
That's right. You can email your questions about the show, and I'm not kidding here, to freakzilla@scopenet.com. That's right. We'll either try to get the answers for you ourselves or direct from the people who put the show together.
It's a dream come true. You can also call and leave a voicemail for us at 646-801-WNYX. If it's relevant or funny or even stupid, as long as it's news radio related, you have a good chance of it getting played on the show. Dispatches from Fort Awesome, a news radio podcast.
All of this talk of aged lunch meat and ghosts has made me peckish.
Equally dumb closing quote.
God damn it, Alan.
Sorry. That's in parentheses. I shouldn't have actually said that.
Please subscribe to Dispatches from Fort Awesome on iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WNYX News Radio.